Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Big week this week, as about a third of the S&P 500 giving out their earnings during this last week. And this big show brought to you by Blinkist, an app that distills the key insights of 2,500-plus best-selling nonfiction books into powerful 15-minute reads. Thank you to our listeners for the continued support, both with the reviews and the likes and subscribing to the Retail Focus Podcast on whichever platform you do prefer. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk about Agree Realty Company's earnings. Agree Realty, not something we talk about a whole lot, but they are a retail-focused REIT. So we'll discuss that as well as the CVS and Aetna merger. We'll talk Tractor Supply Company, and I'll talk about Sleep Number towards the end of the show as they posted an earnings surprise in the positive way this last week. But we begin with Amazon. Amazon, of course, the news on everyone's lips in the retail community. A rare, interesting situation for Amazon in that their stock very volatile over the past week. And so when we talk about the different stock movements after these earnings calls, do keep that in mind, but Amazon down as much as 10% in trading on Friday after their earnings came out Thursday afternoon. And Amazon did miss very slightly on top line, but showed key earnings growth overall. So I want to begin this story just by saying that we're first and foremost a retail podcast, and Amazon has so many distinct branches at this point that affect their overall earnings. We're going to hone in on the retail side of things once we talk about the earnings from a 30,000 foot perspective. Amazon Web Services did show the most robust profit growth, so not their retail division. But in fact, AWS came through with about 55% of Amazon's overall earnings alone. And total net income for the company, Leighton, $2.88 billion versus the $256 million that was brought in last year. So a big bump in bottom line. A lot of that's from non-retail sources. But again, we're going to focus on the retail side here today.
But first, real quick, the total revenues, again, in all segments, increased to a third quarter record of $56.5 billion. Again, a lot of that is made up of all the different segments in the company. And if you were to look at the press release, you wouldn't actually consider them a retail company because most of their main bullet points about the things that they've been doing over the past couple of months are AWS and Amazon Echo related. They have a lot of innovation and a lot of things surrounding all of their content as well. And you have to wonder, has their focus sort of shifted? But again, for this podcast, as Trent pointed out, we are going to be delving mostly into the retail side of things. Shares are down significantly over the past month, not just the past week, as Trent had pointed out, but they've gone down over 20% over the last 4 weeks. Recently, just over $2,000 a share, now around $1,640 a share after all of the additional negative news from the earnings call. You see, it should still be said that the company's market cap is over $800 billion, which is very positive and has returned massive gains over the last few years, but they were the second company so far to hit that $1 trillion mark right after Apple. Now, not the case. Microsoft actually has a bigger market cap than Amazon. I would not have believed that if you told me that 3 years ago that that would have happened. But third quarter earnings on Thursday showed operational and retail strengths for Amazon, with notes that have been highlighting over the past few months, again, details within the company as they seek to grow out their brick and mortar footprint. And these are all topics that we've actually covered on the podcast over the course of the last few weeks, the past few months, in fact. Amazon, of course, launched the Amazon 4-Star Store in New York City, a physical store that carries highly curated selection of products from all of the categories on Amazon's marketplace that are rated 4 stars or above. And what's interesting, Trent, about that concept and what everyone's talking about is that inventory is constantly fluctuating. You get one particular item in for a few weeks, and it may be gone over the next month or two thereafter. So it's sort of an interesting store, sort of a treasure hunt store, if you will. So a lot of things happening there with that brick and mortar concept. And also the Amazon Go rumors talking about thousands of stores throughout the United States. However, it must be noted that in this particular press release for third quarter earnings, they didn't talk about that. And I bet for good reason, because there are a lot of rumors, a lot of internal rumors happening with that company, people saying that they're going to grow out 3,000 stores in the next 2 to 3 years, just crazy numbers out there. But Also, we should note that they did mention something that we have seen in the news and something that has been verified by the company previously, and that the $15 an hour minimum wage for employees is happening. Also, like I had mentioned earlier, a bevy of new Echo devices, but it's going to have improved retail functionality and Alexa functionality, so that's why I mentioned that. Many retailers and service providers are actually switching to AWS Cloud as well. Another thing that they had talked about, growing that market share. Again, already a massive leader in the United States with cloud computing, but it does affect retail and service industry providers that we talk about on this podcast, because they're actually moving their databases over to their main competitor in Amazon. And of course, Amazon would try to switch that up and say that small and medium business owners can actually benefit from using the AWS cloud. So in theory, they're actually helping everybody. There's sort of a larger ecosystem that helps everybody involved. Yelp, just for reference, just finished moving all of their databases over to the AWS cloud. As for retail revenue, I mentioned the total revenue for the company. Retail revenue in North America, it grew by a slightly larger pace than total company revenue. So total company revenue grew about 29%. They brought in, for retail revenue in North America, $34.3 billion. Trent, that's a 35% increase year over year, and operating income for North America retail hit a record $2 billion. So it's a lot of money they're bringing in. And if you compare that to this time last year, it's a massive gain. And internationally, operating income, though, is still negative on the retail front, but still trending in the positive direction, meaning they're actually losing less sequentially quarter over quarter. And Trent, while the amount of money Amazon has brought into the fold from North America, and that again increasing 35%, gross merchandise volume is also up.
Yeah, you look at the gross merchandising volume, or essentially the value of sales that were rooted in Amazon's platform, that grew by 42% to $134.5 billion. We contrast that growth with total retail spending in the U.S., which is slated to grow in the low to mid 5% range overall in 2018. Retail sales themselves grew over 4% in 2017. That's a metric that includes both brick and mortar and online transactions. So you contrast that with the growth in gross merchandise volume at Amazon of 42% year over year for this quarter, and it is quite impressive. We should mention one of the reasons that we've been perhaps less bullish than others regarding Amazon in the past is their inability to squeeze profits out of their retail segment. We've long said AWS, look, that's going to be a profit driver for them going forward. But how does the company actually begin to profit in the retail segment? A little bit more of that net income during this last quarter, and it's ultimately going to be good to see for Amazon and their long-term viability going in the next 10 to 20 years in terms of retail. Now, speaking of those physical stores, Amazon's breakout of their brick-and-mortar revenue showed that they aren't growing in brick-and-mortar year over year. While online sales are historically better in quarter three and quarter four for Amazon, physical store sales actually fell sequentially. Both quarter one and quarter two performed better from the top-line vantage point. Brick-and-mortar sales hit $4.24 billion, roughly 11% of their North American retail revenue. Of course, when we talk brick-and-mortar sales, it's not only some of the Amazon four-star locations and the other concepts they're rolling out, but that giant Whole Foods that they bought last year. And what we see here in the lack of growth is we see that Whole Foods sales aren't really going up as much as some people forecast. I think a lot of analysts were a little bit more tepid in terms of their forecasts for Whole Foods, but some analysts felt like the Amazon purchase of Whole Foods was going to be a game changer for them. We're not seeing that be the case just yet. Not saying that that couldn't happen at some point in the future, but we're not seeing that as being the case just yet. The company is spending more, however, in marketing and technology for their retail segment, but both are relatively representative of how the overall business has grown. We've all seen more television commercials, for example, for Amazon, but now they're also advertising an array of services with AWS in a larger attempt to encourage those small to mid-sized retailers to join that marketplace platform that Leighton discussed earlier. Despite positive statements, too, regarding holiday spending and traffic levels over the next couple of months, and this was a big headline generator for Amazon in this earnings release or after the earnings release, their fourth quarter guidance failed to meet what many analysts were calling for in the way of fourth quarter guidance. So we're talking now about what Amazon sees for the upcoming fourth quarter, and some media outlets called this a revenue slowdown. Not categorically correct, however, given the massive numbers Amazon is still putting out there for guidance. Amazon has forecasted sales of $66.5 billion to $72.5 billion. That is up still 10 to 20% over the same amount that they forecasted last year. And this includes all sales and would be a 17% rise in revenue sequentially at the very minimum. And Leighton, this is why a lot of analysts were kind of taken aback by this, saying Amazon forecasts a holiday slowdown, but it's really a slowdown of growth, which we kind of expect to see as they begin to hit maturity in the retail segment.
You would think that they really do have to slow down eventually because they are growing at such a massive pace, but those all-important holiday sales figures will be bigger this year because of general rise in economic wealth and prosperity. However, now more than ever, they do face stiffer competition from Target and Walmart, both companies we've talked about here recently on the podcast. One with Target, as they begin to grow out a lot of free shipping incentives for their customer base, and they've been competing aggressively also in some specific niche categories that we have really liked to talk about, like toys and women's apparel, trying to grab that market share up, obviously, from those retailers who just haven't been able to cut it, or those retailers that have actually filed bankruptcy lately, namely Toys R Us. Target has come out with free two-day shipping just in time for the holidays, which will stand to eat away at Amazon's service differentiation. And this is something we've talked about, and that brick and mortar has a very important role to play in the retail economy. But Target, if they can offer not only a great brick and mortar experience and also an omni-channel experience, this could actually leverage their strengths, their brand, in order to beat Amazon, or at least beat Amazon's particular categories, specific categories for the fourth quarter. Some have pointed out that soft sales figures for the fourth quarter, those sales figures that Trent outlined, could be construed as a plus considering some antitrust concerns that have come up over the last year or so with the Trump administration. Also, an inherently good thing for Amazon that they have so many interests elsewhere in terms of that antitrust concern. This is really diversifying their antitrust risk because they have so many things going on in so many other categories. Despite the stock's pullback over the last 4 weeks, analysts after the third quarter earnings report remain bullish overall. And so while the market didn't particularly like the news that came out, didn't particularly like some of the points that we have talked about on this story, many analysts that covered the call still have a buy rating for Amazon stock. Again, ticker AMZN. And a lot of price targets out there, Trent, still over $2,100 for the company. It would certainly not surprise us to see the company surpass these marks. Again, these one-year price targets would essentially mean that they expect the company to be at that level or higher in the next year. But some predicting a larger market pullback, so you really have to counter with what the overall economy is going to do and how that's going to be reflective of Amazon's stock price. Again, shares ended for Amazon on Friday at around $1,642 a share. They have a price-to-earnings ratio of 92, now showing that the company is more in that fundamental range where they can actually be valued like a normal institution because they have that substantial net income now coming in. And by the by, Trent, one of their long-standing competitors in eBay, they've given back pretty much all of their gains over the last 2 years. And I felt that relevant to this story because everyone's saying that Amazon is crashing. Well, eBay really has crashed. They now only have a market cap of $27 billion, or around less than 4% of Amazon's total market valuation.
We say only $27 billion, but both of us would kill to have a company whose market cap is $27 billion. Well, speaking of a company that is not crashing, we're going to talk now about Agree Realty. Agree Realty put out earnings this week, and they showed strength in a number of key real estate metrics, but their financials pulled through as well and beat in every measurable way. And while not always a REIT, Agree Realty started off as primarily a development company back in 1971, building dozens of shopping centers around the U.S. They had an IPO in 1994 and haven't looked back, been listed ever since under the ticker ADC. Fast forward to now, they are still growing at a considerable clip. They've issued more equity through multiple offerings over the last dozen or so years, making sure they buy up valuable real estate from around the country. And that's one of the things that we really wanted to touch on, is just how spread out they are. We talk about a lot of different REITs on this podcast, and many of them tend to be a bit more regional. Some of them West Coast or Northwest only, some of them Midwest only, some of them Appalachia only. Well, in the case of Agri Realty, their portfolio now consists of 524 total assets in 45 states. And again, their focus is on retail, and many of the retailers that are in their stores we talk about on this very podcast. Agri Realty has approximately 10 million square feet of gross leasable space. And having assets in 45 states certainly does spread out that geographical risk. If one area in the country is having a harder time than the other, helps to spread that out, mitigate that a little bit, but it does spread them thin operationally, or at least gives them the potential to be spread thin operationally, especially when you consider the fact that they actually self-manage most of their assets. Other REITs, as I've mentioned, they look to stay in a particular region, not Agri Realty. And for their latest quarter, the third quarter, cash flow, earnings per share, and revenue all exceeded Wall Street forecasts. Funds from operations, which is a profitability metric designed to look at cash flow before interest, expense, and depreciation, was $23.4 million or 72 cents per share for this largely retail-centric REIT. This was an over 17% increase year over year, which for a mature REIT, that's pretty amazing.
If you do factor in normal operating expenses and credits and amortization, Agri Realty brought in net income of $15.6 million, so slightly less, of course, than the funds from operations number. Still a very healthy number from the cash flow perspective. The Real Estate Investment Trust posted revenue of $37.3 million in the period, also beating Wall Street forecasts. And five analysts surveyed by Zacks, by the way, expected $37.0 million. So that's a $300,000 beat from the top line perspective. And about 90% of the revenue, and this is important because we tend to delve into REIT analysis a little bit more on this podcast, 90% of revenue is coming directly from retail rents. And you have to look at the other 10%. They're coming from other activities, which most of those actually include rents from ground leases, again, from retailers. So you have to look at the majority of their business. About 96% of their business is made up of retail rents. And jumping right into the highlights here, we can see that the company is still in buying mode. They're looking at a lot of good, solid retailers out there that they want a piece of in terms of their geographic footprint. They really want to hedge risk by having more properties in more states. They are aggressively buying up triple net properties, or what they call net leased properties, properties where tenants pay for insurance, taxes, and most maintenance items associated with keeping the building and parking lot in good standing. And this really works out for them because it simplifies the process. It simplifies management, where a lot of the management is deferred to the retailers. And if you look online, Trent, a lot of retailers have some robust management operations themselves. So not really a lot to have to do, more of a hands-off passive income approach for Agri Realty. And in the third quarter alone, they spent $158 million on 52 new or new to them total retail properties, all being net lease properties. So they really see the value in those triple net properties. And rental revenues were up 23% in the third quarter over last year, thanks again to historical acquisitions. They've been aggressive over the past few years now, and they've almost doubled net income from what we previously noted as well. Anytime a company, especially a REIT, is buying more relative to their historical size, revenue growth will end up surpassing net income growth. Closing fees, interest expenses, due diligence research, all of that underwriting that they have to do internally, all factors that one has to consider when you see their quarterly earnings reports, because even though they are growing at a considerable pace, that is going to eat a little bit into their expenses operationally. And despite that growth, it is always nice to see profits rise. So profits are still rising for the company, and that's exactly what's happening here, as management has smartly acquired some of the nicer properties as far as areas and the tenant base. And to distribute these profits, they are actually doing more than just reinvesting and buying up newer properties from around the nation. They increased their quarterly dividend to 54 cents, which is about 7% higher than it was last year, around 6.9% to be exact, a nearly now 4% yield based off of Monday's closing share price. And the success they are having is due in large part to capital allocation. They have been able to secure great financing with relatively low rates, short-term unsecured debt and long-term revolving lines that are pretty flexible. And some of the rates right now, if you compare them to what the market's requiring of some commercial lenders, and you really have to applaud them here. Some rates are brushing up against 4%. Really great rates for this particular environment where you see a lot of the Fed hikes have trickled down to small and medium-sized banks where they're now seeing increases in commercial lending rates. It speaks to their trustworthiness and operating history for individual lenders and banks because they can see that they've been operating for such a long period of time and doing such a great job at managing these properties that they have really built up that trust factor. And as a result, they're able to actually squeeze out some of these better rates than other companies or other REITs there on the market. And they cite a strong balance sheet too, just 4.7 times net debt to recurring EBITDA. A great figure if you're going to be looking at a REIT to potentially invest in, or if you're looking to actually model your company after one that has a long-standing history in this space.
Joey Agree, who's the president and CEO of Agree Realty, mentioned how pleased they were with their record investment activity. We talk about the number of properties that they're acquiring, still growing almost at a breakneck pace, very pleased with their strategic acquisitions. And what's more is they're increasing their full-year acquisition guidance to a range of $425 million to $475 million. Again, we're talking about acquisitions here. We're not talking about revenue. We're not talking about any of that. We're talking strictly about acquisitions. And they mentioned that they're still focused on their current properties, but they want to continue growing because they have that ability to, and also because of exactly what Leighton talked about. They have access to a lot of low rates, rates that are really low for this economy and for real estate investing. For the 9 months ended September 30th, 2018, they mentioned that total acquisition volume was approximately $351.1 million, included 96 total assets, net lease assets. These properties that they've just acquired in the previous 9 months, ending September 30th, are located across 29 different states. So more of that diversification we talk about. 38 different tenants who operate in 21 different retail sectors. This is the definition of a diversification when you look at a retail REIT. And it's encouraging to see because when we talk about retail on this show, sometimes we'll talk about a particular sector of retail, maybe not having as good a time of it as others. But right now, Agree Realty sees potential across all of these platforms in retail, and they see potential in the leases that they're renegotiating and re-upping over the next little while. So I think this is positive overall for retail, even though we've seen some bumps in the market generally. Just in terms of retail, I think Agree Realty certainly underscores the fact that what you see over the next 10, 15, 20 years, however long these leases are signed for, might be positive. Their weighted average capitalization rate, or cap rate as it's often called in real estate, is 7.2%, which, especially if you're looking at national credit tenants, larger retailers, that's a decent rate to be buying up in these larger acquisitions. And had a weighted average remaining lease term of approximately 12.3 years, which is also remarkable considering there's a lot of retailers out there that don't sign contracts beyond 10 years in the future. So the fact that the properties that they're buying up had an average remaining lease term of 12.3 years and they were able to get these properties at a cap rate on average of 7.2%, that is pretty amazing for the company. But again, it speaks to the optimism, the long-term optimism that Agree Realty has. Looking at their portfolio update, I know Leighton and I are very envious of the operation, just to put it lightly. Their brick and mortar portfolio, so that's activities away from ground leasing, that's approximately 99.7% leased. You compare that to the national average or even a regional average, which could fluctuate anywhere between 90 and 95% right now. Even the best areas only have 97 to 98% lease rates. In this case, you're looking at 99.7%. That's quite amazing. Their overall portfolio has a weighted average remaining lease term of 10.1 years, so a little bit lower than the properties that they bought up in the last 9 months. But they did generate approximately 47.2% of annualized base rents from investment-grade retail tenants. Often, we call that national credit tenants that are in good standing there. And so really is amazing looking at Agree Realty. But I think the point to drive home is this: the REITs in this country that are retail focused right now, They're focused on continuing to grow, continuing to acquire retail assets. And overall, you see this general bullishness, especially towards those A and B grade shopping centers. And I think we expect that to continue over the next couple of years. That 99.7% number, that lease number that we gave you for Agree Realty, that's eye-popping, but this is also eye-popping in that 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. They're hungry for knowledge, continuously seek self-improvement, and learning every chance they get. And you know, Blinkist, our sponsor, gets you there faster than you can imagine. If you're like me, the list of books you want to read or the list of books that people suggest that I read, never ending, always expanding. And I don't have time to read them all. I know you probably don't have the time to read them all either, but our sponsor Blinkist has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all.
Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most powerful, impactful moments so you can read or listen to them in just under 15 minutes, all on your phone. And with Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge base and learn more just in 15 minutes than you can in any other way. Plus, you can listen anytime, anywhere. And I personally love to listen to Blinkist while I'm at work because, Trent, my mind is pretty mindless. So I always love to absorb, to your point, any new information that I can. And I really do believe that knowledge is power. And with Blinkist, it really does allow you to learn while you're on the go or while you're sitting at work on break or while you're pretty much doing anything where you're next to your smartphone.
The Blinkist library is massive. You've got timeless economic classics, just like Freakonomics, for example. It's a little recent to call it a classic, but I still consider it a classic. To Amazon's current bestsellers, like Getting Things Done, I personally recommend something called The 4-Hour Work Week, but there's a lot of different books you can check out. It seems like it's never ending at Blinkist. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. Again, Blinkist.com/retail. CVS and Aetna will soon be one company as regulatory hurdles have been overcome for the most part. There are some caveats here. Rumors were pointing in pretty much all different directions. It depended on the day you looked at the news, whether or not you would think this deal was going through. Some were saying it wasn't going to happen or that the companies would have to shed off substantial assets. And usually there's less scrutiny with companies merging that have less in common. In this case, Aetna being an insurer and CVS selling a lot of prescription drugs, one could look at this like a vertical integration of sorts. However, there still has been, in our opinion, much warranted criticism of the combined company, one issue being privacy and another being a potential conflict with patient choice. And recently, we've seen a lot of mergers in this space, a lot of vertical integration with this space. It's one of the reasons why the Department of Justice was taking a closer and longer look. But on Monday of this week, the U.S. Department of Justice officially approved the merger between one of our favorite retail pharmacies, one of the only major retail pharmacies that's out there at this point in CVS, and then Aetna, the third largest health insurance company as of 2017. And when I say favorite retail pharmacies, I'm speaking more in the bullish terms because we like what CVS is doing. We like many of their initiatives. In the U.S., United Health and Anthem are larger by volume, but Aetna still brings in over $65 billion in annual revenue. That revenue, by the way, has grown an average of 10% per year. Now, in order for the deal to close, and this is that caveat we mentioned, it was stipulated that Aetna must sell off its Medicare portion of the business. And while we don't delve into the complex world of healthcare much on this podcast, namely because it would be false to say that we know a ton extensively about the industry's dynamics, it is very important to understand the main reasons here why CVS would want Aetna. Let's go back to the beginning. After all, they are paying $69 billion for the insurer. Well, the argument for this merger comes from the customer service aspect, where CVS will have better communication with the insurer as to what care is given. And also, they're hoping to uncrack some synergies as far as Aetna subscribers or people with Aetna being directed to the CVS care clinics and to CVS locations. That's why we mentioned consolidation has been a real issue in healthcare, because so many providers are looking to vertically integrate. You're seeing pharmacy benefit managers move in line with retail pharmacies increasingly. And some feel like the merger kind of creates a vacuum for the patient. And in fact, George Slover, a senior policy counsel for the advocacy group Consumers Union, said in the New York Times this week that this particular type of consolidation presents a possibility of potentially reduced competition that may eventually harm consumer choice and quality. That's the problem when you've got vertical integration in the healthcare industry, is you can kind of funnel customers into one particular area.
Yeah, the idea here being that customers insured by Aetna could be forced to downgrade their care or potentially forced to go to CVS clinics for minor issues. So they're going to be sent to CVS clinics. In theory, this is one possibility, instead of going to a primary care physician for something minor. So that is one problem and one possibility that is real and being talked about. The other idea being that CVS may actually subsidize Aetna policyholders. So people who hold Aetna policies on prescriptions may actually pay a lower rate on their weekly, monthly prescriptions. And one could think that that's a good thing, because people do end up paying less. Perhaps they get better service. They pay less on a monthly basis for their prescriptions, their regular prescriptions. However, this could look bad, because if they get a discount, you're then in turn charging others who don't hold Aetna policies more for prescriptions that are basically doing the same thing. So one could look at this and say that that's unfair, and then basically you're forcing customers to funnel into the Aetna system. So there are two issues there that I think that George Slover is really hitting on, and Larry Merlot, the chief executive there at CVS Health that we've often cited during earnings calls, said in a statement that the approval is an important step, bringing together the strengths and capabilities of our two companies to improve the consumer health experience. So again, he's really hitting on that service experience. But to us, it is actually unclear as to what will actually force prices down for any prescription. Here, we're going back to the cost for the actual patient. You could talk about service all day long and the synergies there, but what does that really affect? CVS, the primary thing that they do is sell prescriptions and be a pharmacy benefit manager. And so if synergies really don't help the end consumer, you're not drawing a clear pathway for savings, it does make a lot of people scratch their heads. The service could be better again, and there will be patient data to mull through, but the market dynamics for the number of prescriptions CVS will fill will likely remain the same. I say that because the competition, the layout right now in the market in the United States, is pretty much an oligopoly. There's not really much going on. Walgreens Boots Alliance is there, CVS is there, Rite Aid still operates a few pharmacies throughout the United States, but in general, there are just extremely few players, and arguably they could have more buying power if they process or fill more prescriptions than the 94 million people than they already did last year, but there is no immediate pressure still to lower costs. I say that to say this: Aetna provided health insurance to 22 million people in the U.S. last year. A big percentage of those actually are filling prescriptions at CVS already. So the hope is at least some of the individuals who are not, that are out of network right now, out of the CVS network, will be incentivized to fill prescriptions at CVS in the future, as opposed to Walgreens, Kroger, or Walmart, which all process a ton of prescriptions themselves. Again, it's unclear as to how many people they're going to be able to pick up. And this is what I would like to see through these numbers, because they throw around different numbers here and there, but this really doesn't relate to what's going to be their buying power for prescriptions now going forward. And it doesn't relate to the customer service aspect. You're just going to be dealing with more people. And I'm very confused as to what synergy savings the customers are going to have. I'm sorry to keep harping on that fact, but there just has not been a lot of transparency. CVS's only real motivation, as far as we could tell, to stave off further competition from Walgreens is to lower prices, considering that Walgreens pretty much has the same exact market size now, the same volume as far as retail pharmacies in the United States. But while it may seem like there is strong competition in pharmaceuticals, the profit margins are still quite healthy. So again, it just seems as though there isn't downward pressure on margins. And Trent, it may be the case that CVS is reacting to what is already happening in the healthcare industry, given the amount of consolidation.
Yeah, and since CVS is acting as its own pharmacy benefit manager, some insurers have looked to include their own pharmacy benefit managers. In fact, just last month, the Justice Department also approved the takeover of Express Scripts by the big insurer Cigna. Express Scripts, a major rival when it comes to filling prescriptions, not so much in terms of the retail area of things, but Brian Marcotte, who's the chief executive of the National Business Group on Health, represents large employers here, said companies are essentially feeling pressured to do something different by all of these other deals. It may take years to see how this is going to play out from CVS's perspective, but it appears as though there's not much anyone will be able to do now that the approval from the Justice Department has happened, as long as Aetna sheds that Medicare division. Now, the deal is expected to close by the end of the year. Merlot, again, the CEO at CVS, will lead the combined company going forward. Aetna's CEO will step down and join the company's board of directors. Most states seem to be okay with the move, so far at least, but New York is already considering blocking some provisions of the deal, making the future a little bit more murky. Some statements from the retired regulators that were looking at this deal warned that rules could potentially need to be in place in healthcare that make transactions between PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers, and insurers more transparent, especially with all of this vertical integration. When it's all said and done, shares of CVS were actually down about 3% on Monday to around $71. It's been an up and down year for CVS. A lot of it is due to market volatility, but shares have gone as low as $60 and as high as $80. Currently, a $73 billion market cap and a price to earnings ratio of 23 times. By the way, Walgreens Boots Alliance, the major competitor for CVS, has an identical market cap. Their price to earnings ratio is much lower at 15 times.
We begin our last story with yet another third quarter earnings report, this in one of our favorite brick and mortar retailers in Tractor Supply, where they reiterated what we already knew about them, that the farm and home retailer is operationally sound despite fast-paced growth throughout the United States, throughout the Midwest in particular. Net sales for the company increased 9.3% to $1.88 billion. And this was on the back of 23 new stores in the third quarter for Tractor Supply. But that banner wasn't the only one to grow under their umbrella. They had 7 new PetSense stores as well in the third quarter, with the smaller and more rural pet store concept with PetSense. You really get the idea that they are trying to piggyback on the massive pet food and pet supply industry that is still ever growing throughout the United States. Some analysts say it's around a $69 billion industry. I actually heard that quoted on a recent NPR Marketplace broadcast, but some measures actually peg the pet market to be even bigger at around $109 billion in the United States annually. One could look at the small to mid-sized markets as being underserved, and PetSmart and Petco really shy away from those lesser populated towns. PetSense, they don't. They go straight into those smaller markets, and I think they're really trying to capitalize. But I digress. Total new stores made up around 4% of total sales for Tractor Supply in the third quarter. Same store sales for all of their units, their average units, grew a very healthy 5.1% thanks to an average ticket boost and average transaction growth. We see same store sales were actually 6.6% positive in the third quarter of 2017, one of their hardest comparisons over the last few years. And by the way, management noted this. They said that, you know what? We are extremely proud of our teams because we were up against one of the toughest comps that we've ever faced. And so because of that, they recognized everybody on their teams throughout the earnings call, which we'll get into later. But this marks, Trent, 5 straight quarters of 3% or better store comps for the retailer. E-commerce sales did grow by double digits. They didn't say by how much. I would love to see if it's in the low double digit range. So we're talking like 10 to 15%. Or if it's a bit higher, around 20 to 25%, which we've been seeing from some mature retailers, even Walmart bringing in 30 to 40% e-commerce comps there. But the positive, even though we don't have all of the specific numbers here with Tractor Supply, this was their 25th straight quarter of double-digit e-commerce gains. So that really speaks to the momentum. Even if it is at just 10 or 11%, they are doing a consistent job of executing in the online space. And most of their online orders, by the way, are picked up in store. They cited 70% of their online orders, those click-throughs, those customers come in the store. And Those customers, by the way, may end up buying more than what they just purchased online. This really speaks to their mobile point of sale improvement over the last few years, and you can see that with their technology investment and in-store e-commerce kiosk called Stockyard. So between these kiosks and between the investment in their mobile and e-commerce sites, you can really see that they are improving both sequentially and quarter over quarter. Net income increased over 27% to $116.8 million, really speaking to the fact that while they are investing heavily in technology, they are able to maintain a robust bottom line.
And I think that investment in technology is what has helped this company out, because we covered Tractor Supply over the last couple of years. You know, think back to 2016. This is a company whose e-commerce efforts were really just starting in earnest. They had an e-commerce site, but nothing akin to that Stockyard format or anything that they've got going on today. And as a result, it was highly volatile from quarter to quarter and year to year based on things particularly like weather. And I think we're seeing, with the same store sales growing on top of great comps last year, you're starting to see Tractor Supply Company. You can't weatherproof a company like this in this particular niche market, but you're starting to see them perform a little bit irrespective of weather. Their earnings per share increased 31.9% to 95 cents per share. The company has aggressively bought back shares to help bolster this number, one of the reasons why this number has increased so much. And gross profit increased over 8% on the back of better revenue marks. Notice that we didn't say it grew proportionately versus overall sales growth. This is in part due to gross margin compression. They saw a modest decrease of 16 basis points in gross margin. Couple of factors here. Freight expense was higher, almost entirely related to fuel. We've talked about staffing the freight, but in this case, they mentioned fuel only on the earnings call. Carriers have been trying to pass on their higher cost of doing business, even as fuel prices have kind of peaked and starting to come down in some parts of the U.S., especially in rural areas that Tractor Supply does more of their business in. In a more macro sense, there has been worry about fuel imports. The other aspect of the compressed margins for Tractor Supply comes from selling, general, and administrative expenses. Those increased as a percentage of sales up to 26.6%. Couple of reasons for this as well. Higher executive compensation as a result of executing according to their plan on the new stores was one thing to blame. Higher wages for store staff, but I think the key here is technology, and they've needed to spend the money in technology. So certainly this is something where you feel like you can give them a pass at, because it's this technology that's ultimately going to help their brand grow over a number of the regional competitors that you see throughout the United States for the farm and home stores. Competitors like Atwoods and Big R stores, for example, Baumgars in the upper Midwest, and so on and so forth. Oddly enough, store occupancy costs actually shrunk for Tractor Supply, which is something that we have not seen nor would have expected given the rise in retail rents we're always talking about throughout the United States. One big factor that plays into this is where the stores are at geographically. Layton, you know just as well as I do, landlords in rural areas may know that their spaces see less demand. You don't have the general merchandisers looking to move into those spaces quite as much, and so you're pretty much limited to farm and home stores if you can't get a Shopko to move in, because you know Walmart isn't likely to take over an older space. And if you're in a town of about 5,000 to 10,000 people and Shopko or a store like Shopko isn't in a growing pattern, Tractor Supply might be your only option in that rural area. As a result, you get less money in per square foot, and Tractor Supply can actually use that leverage. This is one of the few retailers that sets up shop usually outside those A and B class shopping centers, almost in isolation, sometimes on the outskirts of larger towns or in those smaller towns, and they can use that to their advantage to squeeze out those lower lease rates, not like the companies that we talk about without a lot of bargaining leverage that are looking to set up in the A and B class shopping centers. I want to go back to a note I made earlier when I started talking about Tractor Supply, which is how the comp sales succeeded for Tractor Supply. Overall, the average ticket grew by more than the average transaction at the register, but both were growing. So this indicates a couple of different things. Product selection is strong. People are coming in more often, and more different people are coming in. Management cited knowing what everyday items to have in their stores. They're starting to carry more convenience items, more habitual consumption items than those one-time purchase items that oftentimes dotted Tractor Supply Company stores in the past. still have those items, but looking for those broader categories along with seasonal assortment for the summer months, those all helped to propel store sales in the third quarter. And unlike most retailers, Tractor Supply does break out unaudited figures from average ticket, which is great. And one of the reasons why we do cover them so often here on the podcast, average ticket this third quarter was $44.96. That sets up very favorably against $43.39 in the third quarter of last year. Of their product selection, they actually sold less private label merchandise, one of the reasons they think average ticket might have gone up. And that's relative to total sales volume. Approximately 31.5% of items sold were in their exclusive brand category. That's down as a percentage of sales from the past. Total imports as a percentage of sales were also less. That's around 11%. Curious to see this figure in a bigger retailer, say Walmart or Costco. And I think mentioning this number is certainly perhaps one of those reasons why people in the backs of their minds might be thinking about Tractor Supply Company as not necessarily a complete tariff-proof retailer, but one retailer that may not have the same issues with tariffs as others do.
Yeah, it's really interesting to your point, Trent, about their level of transparency, how the management is pretty much bullish on giving analysts and even people like us, sort of in the podcasting realm, a really clear look into their business and to see how they do operationally, where they buy their products. Again, the average ticket, some companies don't even mention the increased percentage in average ticket. They'll just say that the average ticket over the quarter was positive or negative, but here we're able to see the exact value of each individual transaction on an average basis. Inventory per store was actually listed on their formal press release, and this could have played a role as well in those same store sales increases. Management has actually been pushing for more seasonal merchandise and fuller looking stores, so that's going to tie in directly with the inventory they carry on a per store basis. And as a result, inventory per store, so average inventory per store, was 4% higher, reaching $828,000 per store by the end of this latest quarter, this latest third quarter. Again, another figure we would love to have with other well-known retailers. This figure was around $796,000 this time last year. So it really shows you that they are bullish on their product selection. And despite higher quantities of merchandise, inventory turn was higher, meaning that they are supposed to be bullish on their product selection because it is apparently working. People are buying more of the same inventory, and that's going to create a higher inventory turn overall. Reiterating that management, what they've been saying is right about having identified the right product assortment for the right base, the right customer base, the right new customer coming in and being intrigued by that seasonal merchandise and executing on that assortment. And as for the standout category for them, they didn't list a lot of categories like other retailers might during their press release, but outdoor power equipment sales, they mentioned, were up. So those larger ticket items really would play a role in same store sales. Lastly, marketing and integrated merchandising efforts were said to have boosted traffic. They've really gotten a bigger impression from their customer base that they love the seasonal merchandise towards the front of the stores. They love to be able to put it out there for them to really see, make it a more of an impactful experience for those customers coming into their stores. CEO Greg Sanford said on the call that, you know, it really has been a trying last few months for them as they've had several members of their teams help out with the damage that was inflicted by the hurricanes. Unlike the statistics we've actually received last year with Home Depot and Lowe's for the state of Texas, it is not yet abundantly clear how the company was affected or even in what capacity. So he did not go into the details of how financially they've been hit hard, but he said that their thoughts and prayers are certainly with the employees affected by the hurricanes and the damage. As a CEO would, Sanford went on to speak about the larger operational metrics for the company. He said that store operations, supply chain, and planning were all executed to his liking, above and beyond expectations. And he said that he mentioned how basic assortment is driving traffic because of consistency, and customers now have a better idea based on that concept that they go into a store and they now know what to expect when they step foot inside a Tractor Supply.
Now, outside of internal influences, which Sanford did mention a lot of, he mentioned the fact that they were executing to his liking in a key number of areas, they were pretty honest with the management team about the fact that there is just more money floating around in the economy, and those external factors are helping them out as well. They cited unemployment rates being so low and consumer confidence being fairly high. And in particular, they've looked to specific growth markets where they operate to capitalize on strong economic indicators. One example being from areas now with renewed oil production as the price of gas goes up. So it's interesting because as the price of fuel goes up, hinders tractor supply somewhat in those selling, general, and administrative expenses, but also helps in that some of the rural areas they set up shop in are key oil producers here domestically. We get the sense that they're also pretty confident they can pass the increased cost of doing business onto the consumer, like increased fuel costs, for example. The inflationary environment is not really seen as detrimental for tractor supply at this point. On the surface, it does make sense that as employees get higher wages, they'll be able to absorb pricing impacts on consumer goods, particularly discretionary items. However, if certain fixed items such as fuel rise disproportionately, consumer behavior on the optional goods like pet toys, for example, which is a huge category for tractor supply, and seasonal decorations, another big category, may be more elastic long term. Still, the higher levels of discretionary income could definitely correlate to an increase in big ticket sales, as we noted earlier with power equipment, and as Home Depot certainly has noted over the last couple of years. Tractor Supply ended the quarter with 1,748 stores in 49 different states. They also own PetSense, one thing that we haven't really talked about a ton on this earnings call. We've been focusing on the Tractor Supply portion of their business, but PetSense, oftentimes a lower square foot pet store than what you're used to seeing with Petco or PetSmart, they have those stores in 27 states, most of them in small to medium-sized markets. The company did increase guidance, by the way, in all key metrics, including revenue, same-store sales, and profit. The lower effective tax rate did help with this, but also the assumption of some continued improvement in in-store performance, like those same-store sales metrics we talked about earlier that impressed us, certainly. Shares of Tractor Supply Company were up 7% on Thursday after the prepared quarterly release. Now, granted, the market as a whole was up pretty decently on Thursday. Shares did end in Friday's trading session at $90.84. This is well within the one-month trading band you've seen from them of $84 to $92 per share. Year-to-date, though, the company is up 20%. And we remember the times back in 2016 and 2017, the company was fluctuating around the 60s and 70s. But currently, they have a market cap of $11 billion, price-to-earnings ratio of 22 times, which might be seen as a little lofty for some analysts, even with the recent success. But again, they continue to figure on expanding in terms of number of locations. They continue to figure on expanding those same-store sales for the time being. And we do have to remember that they can technically be placed in the same retail genre, very loosely, of Home Depot and Lowe's, which both see continuing market prospects and loftier price-to-earnings ratios than some other areas of retail.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I cite a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And actually, this week, I'm going to lead off here, and I'm looking at Sleep Number. Now, the reason I'm looking at Sleep Number is this. Leighton mentioned a few episodes ago when we were talking about Mattress Firm, about the bevy of articles talking about how Casper and Purple and a lot of the other mail-order mattress companies killed the Mattress Firm. We were kind of critical of those articles. We think that it's kind of silly to point the blame at those companies, especially when those companies are striving to have a larger brick and mortar presence. Mattresses aren't all about mail order at this point, and Sleep Number actually showed that in their most recent quarter, posting an earnings beat. In fact, their stock was up 14% in trading right after their earnings came out, after they topped third quarter consensus estimates. They actually noted that sales orders grew 19% year over year in the last 7 weeks of the quarter. Now, sales orders don't necessarily correlate to revenue coming in that particular order because sometimes there is a lag. So that's something to note with Sleep Number, the fact that sales numbers were up 19% year over year towards the end of the quarter. So you're going to see that revenue bump come in the fourth quarter. Generally speaking, Sleep Number's numbers were great. And Shelly Ibach on the call mentioned not only her Sleep IQ score, which was 80 the night before the call. So that's pretty good for a night before an earnings call for any retail executive. But the fact that sales orders went up and the fact that overall sales in the third quarter were up and even the revenue coming in was up, that's a good sign. What we should also keep an eye on, not only the sales numbers resulting in higher revenues in the fourth quarter, but also their marketing expense. One of the interesting things for Sleep Number is that their sales and marketing went up as a percentage of sales from 43.4% to 45.4%. So it could be then that perhaps the key to keeping up with the mail order mattress companies of the world, like the Caspers, like the Purples of the universe, is to simply market better. And this is something that we both thought, Leighton and I both thought, Mattress Firm didn't ever do a good job of doing, was really marketing themselves well. Well, Sleep Number has recognized the importance, and they mentioned the fact that that increased marketing helped their top line along. Their top line grew from $402.6 million a year ago in the quarter to $414.8 million this year in the quarter, even if their gross profit did shrink a little bit more as a percentage of sales because of that advertising expense. So they are bringing more people into the store, and those sales numbers are up. I'll be keeping an eye on their fourth quarter in particular to see if their marketing expense remains high and also to see if they can find a way to squeeze out more profit from all those new sales coming in.
Well, speaking of profit, my looking ahead has to do with Mattel earnings, which actually came out on Thursday. And you can see a slight boost in after hours trading, but then the stock dipped yet again because earnings per share were actually down versus analyst forecast. Revenue was also down. However, there are positives, Trent, in that the operating income for the third quarter was actually positive. It was up massively by 41% versus the comparable year ago period. And for North America, Mattel said they've actually been seeing a lot of strength. And one main reason is because of Barbie. So Mattel obviously has the Barbie license. Barbie sales were up 14% worldwide from a year ago. Total sales did fall 8%. If you dig into those numbers, the concern really shouldn't be that great as to what it was maybe a year ago when the rumors about Toys R Us were closing their doors were first starting to come about, because the company noted that while Toys R Us did negatively impact their business, the liquidation impacts were actually fairly small, just around 3% negative. And then also the China slowdown there, a lot less consumer action there in the toy market caused another 3% decline. So total, an 8% drop off in total revenue. But again, these numbers could be a lot worse, especially because of statements made throughout the last 6 months, especially by Hasbro, saying that a lot of their inventories are going to be hit in the double digit figures because of Toys R Us. So the company did report, they ended up reporting a net income of $6.3 million, and this compares to a $603 million loss last year. And as a result, the company said they are actually making meaningful progress to being profitable, and I'm extremely curious to see what this means for their distribution throughout the United States. Are their products going to come in a little bit cheaper? Or are they going to remain maybe a little bit more varied in terms of what they can give the customer in terms of a diversified product base? Meaning, are they going to be including more technology into their products with their iconic brands, or are they not? And I think this is a very important question. But as for now, it seems as though the management, again, this is because it's my looking ahead story, they seem to be focused on more cutbacks. They actually said they are seeking strategic alternatives for their manufacturing footprint. So again, lowering the cost of goods sold. And also, they're following through with the plans to lay off nearly a quarter of their staff, 2,200 workers. That was announced in July of this year. So really big changes, really meaningful changes inside of Mattel. I'm just curious to see if cutting back expenses, cutting back on your staff, is actually going to have a meaningful impact on boosting revenues in the future, or if it's more of what Sears Holdings just went through over the last 12 years, where cost cutting really doesn't mean growing your business. So as for now, their rival Hasbro did say that they are also laying off 10% of its staff. In general, you could say that maybe the toy market is just consolidating, and this is part of a natural cycle that's occurring in this industry, because Toys R Us, for all of their brand awareness and brand equity, really wasn't doing that well either. But As for now, we are curious to see what this means for the holiday season, and as for Mattel going forward as a publicly traded company.
Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. Big thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. We'll be back 7 days from now with more retail news and information.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.